news, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe, taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia and a bunker below ground, welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad to be with you yet again as we begin our weekly pursuit of the enigmatic like we do every Monday night here on KGRARadio.com. And of course, listen on demand anytime, anywhere, evergreen via podcasting apps carried in pockets all around the globe. So as always, glad to be here with you guys. We've got a lot to cover this week. You know, there's been word out of Washington that the UFO truth embargo may be ending. Yeah, more on that a bit later. Also, what Boston University recently had to say about UFOs, what they are not, and why it matters. But I also want to spend a little time this week looking at questions related to consciousness. Neuroscience. What exactly is consciousness? How does the brain function in relation to that? And what does it mean? What is the bigger picture? Then later in the program, joining us is a guest I wanted to talk to for quite some time, Dr. Jim Tucker of the University of Virginia. He has spent decades now investigating claims of child memories of past lives. But I've got some rather unique questions for him about that subject. And of course, we're going to look at what also that might mean in terms of everything from quantum physics to, yes, those enduring questions about consciousness. Lots to get into this week. Certainly looking forward to this conversation. And of course, as always, I hope all of you out there are doing extremely well as we kick off another week here in the bunker. I have to say, I've also been uniquely blessed in recent days because of the number and the quality of conversations I've been having with some of my colleagues out there in the research community about, you know, really everything from UFOs to those enduring mysteries like consciousness itself. Often when I have conversations with Tim McMillan, it really kind of ends up being a mishmash of all those things. We'll start with UFOs and government policy and all that kind of stuff, and by the end of the conversation, we're discussing whether or not consciousness actually exists in a bioelectric field around the human brain. That was actually a theory proposed by Dr. John Joe McFadden a number of years ago, but you know, all these kind of things remain on my mind pretty much all the time. And in truth, they have for quite some time. I was thinking over the weekend, in fact, with all of the news about UFOs and with, of course, all the reporting on that subject, you know, the media is always trying to find experts, and they're going to some people who have been long involved with the UFO issue, and as we discussed last week, they also talk with a lot of experts in other areas which may not have any relevance to UFOs really, but they need their scientific expert who can come on and provide some sort of commentary, some sort of view, some sort of opinion. And it's kind of fascinating to guys like me when I'm seeing the variety of opinions doing very little in terms of helping us broaden our understanding of what the phenomena might represent. At times, admittedly, it looks a lot like there are a lot of very qualified professionals in their disciplines, but who are newbies to the study of the UAP issue, and they're the ones being quoted in the media trying to provide sensible explanations for what may or may not be happening right now. And so naturally, it was of interest to me, and I had to kind of chuckle when Mark Brady sent along, as he always does, a news headline with the following lead: Truth Embargo, UFOs are suddenly all the talk in Washington. That's right, an NBC News piece using very instantly recognizable phraseology with that term truth embargo. In fact, in recent days, you may recall having heard that right here on this program as we were discussing Stephen Bassett and his recent response in a Paradigm Research Group newsletter after the New York Times article that gave us the sneak preview on the UAP Task Force report dropped just the other day. And as they note here, Stephen Bassett and Mick West don't agree on much. Bassett has devoted much of his adult life to proving UFOs are helmed by aliens, and West has devoted much of his to proving they are not. But, as NBC notes, they both agree on one thing. It's good that after nearly 75 years of taboo and ridicule going back to Roswell, New Mexico, serious people are finally talking seriously about the unidentified flying objects people see in the skies. Now, I have to admit, despite my criticisms of maybe the lack of informed discussion about this topic that often prevails in the media, that's not necessarily the case with either of the two gentlemen being cited here. Respective of the opposite extremes ideologically that they come from in approaching it, nonetheless, they are better informed, I'd think, than most. But really, the big takeaway from this article, and maybe the hopeful point that it actually raises, is that there are a lot of things that people, regardless of their opposing viewpoints, that they actually have in common. And for anybody who's really interested in the UFO phenomenon, what it might represent, what it could mean, whether it's something that is worthy of scientific study, I think we all really would agree that it's good that people are talking about it and that it is getting as much attention as it gets. And that, I think, also holds true even when I don't necessarily see astronomers or scientists or, you know, politicians or anybody else who, in my opinion, based on their knowledge of the subject, are necessarily qualified to be talking about it. The other side of that coin, of course, is that it's great that they're the ones talking about it. We want more scientists who haven't spent decades studying this phenomenon talking about it. We certainly want politicians who have the ability to pass laws and legislation that may enact things like the UAP Task Force and its forthcoming report. You know, again, this effort really kind of spearheaded last year by Marco Rubio, although there are a lot of folks in government who have been instrumental in this process. But again, yeah, maybe it's good that we've got more politicians beginning to take interest in this topic, maybe having received briefings on certain aspects of it, and really trying to get the ball down the court, so to speak, in terms of what government is actually doing about it. And as Harry Reid has said many times in recent days, maybe this should end up being a long-lasting study. This shouldn't just be a quick report. Here's 120 things we looked at. Here are our findings. We don't know what they are. There you go. No, this should probably be an ongoing thing, considering the potential weight behind this subject. You know, I saw Eric Weinstein, by the way, tweeting over the weekend saying, if UFOs are aliens, this is the biggest story ever, basically. I'm paraphrasing, but the gist of it was, he said, it's the biggest story ever if these things are aliens, and if it's not aliens, this is still the biggest story ever. And in a roundabout way, really, no matter how you look at it, this is a significant story, and therefore he says that the discussion about it, therefore, in some way is kind of being managed. Now, McWest had criticized this tweet and had said, you know, this is basically a nonsensical statement from Weinstein, but I would disagree. Not the first time I've disagreed with McWest. You know, this, to me, is very significant because no matter what your approach to the topic is, people are talking about it, and really, one might argue it is essentially the most significant discussion being had by anybody, anywhere right now. Which really brings us back full circle to this NBC article the other day, where they quote West saying, if you look at the level of public interest, then I think it becomes important to actually look into these things. Right now, there is a lot of suspicion that the government is hiding evidence of UFOs, which is quite understandable because there's this wall of secrecy. It leads to suspicion and distrust of the government, which, as we've seen, can be quite dangerous. But NBC then coming over to Stephen Bassett. They quote him here, the truth embargo is coming to an end now. I am elated to finally see this movement achieving its moment. A movement, of course, which Bassett has really been behind now for some time. And to Mick West's earlier point about the contention held by many that the government has been withholding what it knows about this subject from the public, NBC notes, Bassett is convinced the government is covering up proof of extraterrestrial life and that everything happening now is elaborate political theater to make that information public in the least disruptive way possible. A view, of course, not supported by evidence or most experts. But again, as we had kind of talked about last week, recall that he said it's a lie essentially being presented to undo decades of lies, which, to summarize, he said, hey, works for me. But of course, in the NBC article there by Alex Seitz-Wald, which I'll have linked in the show notes in case anyone would like to take a lengthier look at it, to summarize, he notes, both the skeptics and the believers don't expect the Pentagon report to settle anything. Instead, they hope it will start something new. But if it does nothing else, and of course they give the last word to Mick West, he says, the idea of some super powerful aliens coming to visit us is a very compelling story. So if you get even a tiny little taste of something like that, it really spices up the story. Admittedly, that's kind of an odd quote from Mick West for them to choose to end on, especially given his skeptical leanings, but nonetheless, again, the big takeaway here, whatever the outcome of the report is, nobody expects it to really resolve this issue, but everybody seems to be glad that they're talking about it. Yeah, and that seems to be the case. Everybody's talking about UFOs. Such, in fact, was also the case over there in a recent piece for Boston University Today that featured a Q&A with Thomas Benaiah, an astronomer, and Jack Weinstein, a Pardee School of Global Studies professor of the practice of international security and a retired Air Force lieutenant general. And for this piece, they had asked Weinstein any doubts about the government's reported conclusion that the recent sightings aren't extraterrestrials. And here again, to my earlier point, how many qualified experts in their fields are being asked about UFOs, but who seemingly have no knowledge on this topic? Listen to what Jack says. I have no expertise in UFOs except for watching Men in Black. I never flew for the Air Force. I was a nuclear and space guy. Never did we track something that we thought was a UFO. That said, he adds, my concern with the report is that it stated it could be a foreign power's technology. Well, yes, that's certainly a possibility. I have raised my own conjectures in recent days as to why I think that seems unlikely, but listen to what Jack says after that. After stating his concern, he goes on to say the UFO sightings dating back into the 50s and 60s were never technology that we were able to see later on from a foreign power. That never materialized, he said, later into a foreign nation having a capability like that. Now, for a guy who has no expertise in UFOs, I have to say he's making a very valid observation right there, and one I have continued to reiterate. Maybe, just maybe, he listens to this program. Who knows? But I mean, that's exactly what I've been saying. None of the observations from decades past ended up coming to fruition and revealing that a foreign adversary had these technologies, let alone that the U.S. had those technologies. People today continue to try and treat this as though, well, it's probably just the Navy, probably just some stuff we cooked up out there at Area 51. Again, the most significant takeaways from the advanced reporting the New York Times did on the UAP Task Force and its findings is that A, it doesn't appear to be our technology, but that they don't rule out the possibility it belongs to somebody else. And I told you really what to me is significant about that. To summarize briefly, the most significant aspect of that to me really has to do with the fact that it is perceived that some of the phenomena being witnessed is a technology. And in order to try and account for where it could possibly come from, of course they can't rule out that China or Russia might have it, but yet again, I think that that's extremely unlikely in many instances. So coming back to Jack Weinstein's perspectives here, again, we've got this former Air Force guy, a Pardee School of Global Studies professor on international security, and he's saying, you know, in the 50s and 60s, the things that people were seeing never materialized later into a foreign nation having a capability like that. Now, he goes on to say, I can't comment on whether they're UFOs or not because I don't want to look like a kook, to be blunt. All I'm saying is that if a foreign power develops technology, then later on we'd see technology like that from them, either in operation or in testing. For my own part, I think that's a very well-worded statement. I think he's actually 100% on point, but I'm troubled by the fact that he is reticent to comment further on account of, as he says, being called a kook. And in my opinion, if you are a respected American professor and you're being asked about UFOs in a non-controversial environment like this, you know, a Boston University Today Q&A, I mean, I don't think that you should be worried about sounding like a kook. I admire him for his being candid, but again, really, I think that we need to get beyond this stigma that, oh, if you even talk about this subject, you're going to be labeled a kook. Meanwhile, they come over to Thomas Bonaya, the astronomer who also participated. He says, do any of us believe these are actual flying saucers from outer space? No, but there really isn't enough information to evaluate what's going on. Now, we could spend all day trying to break that statement down, but really I think it may be a bit broad and sweeping to assume that no one believes these are actual flying saucers from outer space. Obviously, Professor Bonaya doesn't. Perhaps his colleagues don't either. But he does say the government shows images of these objects and they have ruled out extraterrestrial technology. Well, have they actually? I don't think they've ruled out extraterrestrial technology at all. They simply said that there's no evidence that supports that. If anything, they said there's no evidence, but because there's so little evidence, they can't rule anything out. So no, they haven't ruled that out. Bonaya goes on to say, yet they then say these things have enormous speeds and do maneuvers that are impossible to replicate by our technology. He says all of those claims require that we know the distance to the target. And he goes on to give us a breakdown of why there aren't reliable measurements of speed and acceleration that really give us an idea of what these technologies, if that's what they are capable of. But all of that, in my opinion, predicated upon a couple of flawed statements. A, that nobody apparently believes these things are flying saucers from outer space. And B, also that the government ruled out extraterrestrial technology. I think I'd have to hand the win to Weinstein on that one because, again, he really phrased it the best. Non-UFO expert though he is, I think he's absolutely correct that if indeed things seen in the 50s and 60s do represent a technology, where was the evidence that should have come forward later on in support of that belonging to somebody else? Now, one more piece I'd like to analyze here as we are doing our UFO news in this opening segment before we get into some consciousness discussion. Unlike some of the people we've been commenting on, Leonard David, who is a space reporter, does certainly seem to have followed the UFO topic more maybe than the average reporter over the years, although he tends to gravitate more towards skeptical conclusions. And he did a piece there at Scientific American recently titled Experts Weigh In on Pentagon UFO Report. And as Leonard David, whether he's writing for Space.com or any other outlet, normally does, he quotes Bob Schaefer, probably a friend and colleague of his of many years. And according to Schaefer, a leading UFO skeptic who is quoted in the article here, he says there's not going to be any big reveal. Schaefer says, unequivocally, there are no aliens here on Earth, and so the government cannot disclose what it does not have. He adds, some people think that the government knows more about UFOs or UAPs than the public, but it's clear that they know less on the subject than our best civilian UFO investigators, not more. And I actually, here again, have to agree with Bob Schaefer right there. I'm not so convinced that the government necessarily has any more information about this phenomenon or has taken any more interest in it apart from assessing any potential threat it might represent. Yeah, I'm not so sure the government necessarily knows more about UFOs than civilian researchers. And although Bob Schaefer absolutely rules out the possibility that aliens are in any way associated with UFOs, there are no aliens here on Earth, he says, and so the government can't disclose what it does not have. You know, for me, the whole alien thing is still in the camp where we can't rule that out, and therefore I leave that open to possibility, but show me the evidence. That's where my mind is on that. But I absolutely agree with Bob Schaefer that really, what we're seeing right now may indicate that the government doesn't know as much as certain civilian UFO investigators about this topic. Maybe, in fact, some government studies that are looking at the problem would do well to talk to those civilian investigators, get their opinions on things, outsource some of their data, and say, hey guys, you're the ones who have been analyzing this now for decades. What do you think? They handed us 120 reports. Huh, these things seem to travel through the water. What could it possibly all mean? A lot of folks may have actually deeper insights on that than they do. Those of us out here in the public sphere, all right, we're going to turn our attention toward consciousness when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Arguably, some of the greatest mysteries that we face as team civilization may actually reside right within our own minds. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Of the many mysteries that remain about the nature of reality, I mean, I think fundamentally, questions about consciousness, human perception, these are some of the most interesting ones to me. And even at times, certain aspects of that area of inquiry may actually have some relationship to the UFO phenomenon. There have been a lot of UFO researchers over the years who have said, maybe rather than just tangible nuts and bolts craft, maybe there are deeper questions we should be asking about UFOs and what they might represent. And in truth, even if they are physical nuts and bolts craft of some kind, some sort of technology, human perception nonetheless is still an important question in that regard. But even if we don't go so far as to try and make associations between other unexplained phenomena and human perception, the mind, all these kinds of things, even if we just stick in the realm of what is consciousness, how does that govern our living experience, you know, these are to me still fundamentally some of the greatest questions about all of reality and the experience that we all share as humans. And another question, of course, has to do with really what role consciousness and, of course, advances in neuroscience and our understanding of the workings of the human brain, what role those actually play in terms of our fundamental philosophical concepts like, for instance, free will. And the other day I came across a very interesting article there at Eureka Alert, which addresses this very question, the relationship between or the impact neuroscience has on the idea of free will and, more importantly, as some have argued over the years, whether it actually undermines the idea of free will. According to this new research from Dartmouth College, they said, for decades, researchers have debated whether the buildup of certain electrical activities in the brain indicates that human beings are unable to act out free will. Experiments spanning the 1960s and 1980s, they say, measured brain signals non-invasively and led many neuroscientists to believe that our brains make decisions before we do. Now think about that for a moment. Our brains essentially know what we're going to do before we think we actually make the decision. And therefore, they say, human actions were initiated by electrical waves that didn't reflect free conscious thought. Now, one might ask, really, what does this have to do with consciousness? Of course, there are those who argue that consciousness itself is essentially an illusion, and that this is essentially a byproduct of the many mechanical processes that our physiology is carrying out, that our brain and all the complex underlying processes are performing. Consciousness, as we perceive it, arises from all of that. And in truth, many of those functions are occurring on such subtle levels and even in advance of decisions that we make. Enough so that neuroscientists have begun to say, you know, really, there's so much happening in the brain, it would be very difficult to say that we actually are making decisions ourselves. However, they say, a new article in Trends in Cognitive Science argues that the recent research undermines the case that has been made in the past against free will. According to Adina Roskies, Hellman Family Distinguished Professor and Professor of Philosophy at Dartmouth College, who co-wrote this article, she says, "This new perspective on the data turns on its head the way well-known findings have been interpreted. The new interpretation accounts for the data while undermining all the reasons to think it challenges free will." Now, the research which previously had drawn such conclusions occurred in the 1980s primarily. It involved electroencephalograms that were used to study brain activity, and basically what they found was that they measured when electrical signals begin to build in the brain relative to when a person is aware of their desire to make a movement, and found, of course, what became known as the readiness potential. In other words, these electrical signals and their buildup very obviously precedes any movement or even any choice in a movement being made. But now researchers at Dartmouth College have challenged some of the premises upon which this research was based, and as they explain, because the averaged readiness potential reliably precedes voluntary movement, people assumed that it reflected a process specifically directed at producing that movement. As it turns out, as our model has shown, that is not necessarily the case, this according to Aaron Scherger, an assistant professor of psychology at Chapman University, who also was one of the co-authors of this article. And to summarize, the researchers say that using computational modeling, it has indicated that the standard interpretation of this so-called readiness potential should be reassessed, particularly for its relevance to the question of free will. Now, of course, there certainly is plenty more that could be said about the question of free will, what it is, whether we actually have it. I'll just throw in here that there was a very interesting essay on that subject written by Sam Harris a while back, and now Sam Harris, this leading atheist, this leading philosopher, now beginning to weigh in ever so slightly, but more and more on the UFO topic. Very interesting to see guys like Sam Harris engaging with that subject, especially after having essentially spent his entire career looking at what we're discussing right now. Free will, does it exist? And does neuroscience in any way actually overcome or at least represent certain hurdles for the idea of free will? But according to this new study, they say no. But in my opinion, I would simply say, does it necessarily matter? If there are electrical symbols, this readiness potential, as they call it, you know, does that necessarily matter in terms of its relevance to the decision-making actions taken by human beings? At least for my own part, I would simply say that it doesn't necessarily, to me, matter whether there are complex arrays of phenomena occurring within our bodies that are so subtle that the average human isn't even aware of them. Really, nobody's aware of them. Without the aid of something like an electroencephalogram, you know, to me, it doesn't necessarily take away from the idea of decision-making, free will, the philosophical implications of that, merely to observe that there is a whole lot more going on behind the scenes with humans than any of us are really consciously aware of. But on that subject of consciousness, you know, I'm also seeing more and more questions being raised in recent days about not only what consciousness is and what that means to humans and how it actually governs our living experience, but also whether consciousness might apply to other things, not just animals, maybe even to the universe itself. And that brings us to a very interesting piece from Popular Mechanics in recent days, where they note that in upcoming research, scientists will attempt to show that the universe indeed does have consciousness. Now, you know, one of the things that we have to keep in mind about consciousness is when we're saying the universe may have consciousness, we have to also clarify what do we mean by that? What do we mean when we say consciousness? The PopMech article even says, you know, the basic definition of consciousness intentionally leaves a lot of questions unanswered. Intentionally ambiguous might be a good way to describe it. But they go on to note, scientists simply don't have one unified theory of what consciousness is. We also don't know where it comes from or what it's made of. Given those criteria, I guess it's easy to see why we might extend the idea of consciousness to the universe itself. But as they report here at PopMech, they say, however, one loophole of this knowledge gap is that we can't exhaustively say other organisms and even inanimate objects don't have consciousness. Humans relate to animals and can imagine, say, dogs and cats have some amount of consciousness because we see their facial expressions and how they appear to make decisions. But just because we don't relate to rocks or the ocean or the night sky, that isn't the same as proving that those things don't have consciousness. But interestingly, in this article, their search for the nature of consciousness and whether it might apply even to inanimate objects or the universe itself takes us right back to the good old-fashioned free will conundrum. As Carolyn Delbert writes in her article here, she says, one of the leading minds in physics, 2020 Nobel laureate and black hole pioneer Roger Penrose, has written extensively about quantum mechanics as a suspected vehicle of consciousness. In 1989, he wrote a book called The Emperor's New Mind, in which he claimed that human consciousness is non-algorithmic and a product of quantum effects. She later goes on to ask, are our brains simply cranking out math-like processes that can be telescoped in advance, or is something wild happening that allows us true free will, meaning the ability to make meaningfully different decisions that affect our lives? I have to say, it's great to see dialogue like this in popular mechanics, or anywhere for that matter, because I'm sure that if you're anything like me, this question has probably come to mind for you also. And in fact, just to further illustrate that, I asked a few of you guys out there recently your thoughts about consciousness over on my Facebook page, and that, by the way, can be found at facebook.com/MicahHanksOfficial. And in addition to posting about the podcasts and things, I occasionally put questions out there to you guys and engage in some dialogue. And so I asked, you know, what is consciousness? What does it mean to you? Why is it important? Got some really great responses. Shane Pressler writes, I almost think of consciousness as a sense just like vision or hearing. And just like some people have better vision than others, some people's consciousness is higher than others. He says, the function of understanding, the way things happen, the why, the being able to plan for the future are all things that we have that separate us from most of the rest of the animal kingdom, but the degree that people use that sense is different. The ability to plan ahead and not just react to our base animalistic tendencies is probably the most important aspect of being human. I imagine that before that was discovered, it would have been like having sight but growing up in complete darkness, only reacting to what you can feel, smell, and hear. I like to think that the first person to figure it out was like the first person being raised in darkness finding the entrance to the cave. That's very well said, Shane. We also had Mario Martin chiming in. He said, in my opinion, ancient Greek and Roman philosophers such as Plato, Aristotle, Seneca defined it greatly. Buddhism should be taken into consideration as well. Consciousness could be the existence of our own and personal self in the context of our living reality, at least in this realm of existence or dimension. Also very well worded. See, this is why I ask you guys from time to time what you think. Steve Bounds, I have been thinking about this, especially since the episode with your brother. And I believe that you talked about biotechnology. For me, the big questions are, as you talked about, can it be passed into or uploaded into a machine? And if so, what happens to the body after the upload? Like the Amazon series Upload, will the body be dead? Then if your memories and everything is able to be uploaded, is it just a computer simulation taking over at that point? Will that robot of you be able to create a new human being with a new consciousness? Then also, where does the soul fit into all of this? That also a really great perspective, Steve, and really it kind of brings us up to the edge of the conversation we're about to have with Dr. Jim Tucker, because very similar to the questions he asks about consciousness as it may relate to technology, what if we think of our bodies, we as humans, as a form of technology, somebody or something's technology? And what if indeed the intelligence or the consciousness component is not something that is specific only to the physical existence? In other words, what if there is some portion of our consciousness, our minds, our souls even, that can actually transcend the physical body? And that certainly is a question that through science, Dr. Jim Tucker at the University of Virginia has been talking about now for decades, and he has attempted to try and also apply clinical psychological approaches toward understanding what it might all mean, and indeed whether there is evidence of past life memories that some children have. We're going to get into that conversation with Dr. Tucker and a whole lot more when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. Do children, early in life, occasionally remember things that their own living experience can't account for? In other words, is it possible that they have memories that extend from beyond their short lifespans as children? Are they actually remembering what we might only be able to classify as memories of a past life? Welcome back. And for this segment of the program, I have really been looking forward to the conversation that we are going to be having and the guest who joins us to discuss this. Dr. Jim B. Tucker is a child psychiatrist and Bonner Lowry Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. His main research interests are documenting stories of children whom he claims remember previous lives, and natal and prenatal memories. Now, he is author of Before, Children's Memories of Previous Lives. This actually a fully updated 2-in-1 edition combining Dr. Tucker's best-selling books about children who remember past lives, Return to Life, and Life Before Life. I'm eager to dive into this fascinating subject with him. First and foremost, Dr. Tucker, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, it's truly a pleasure to talk with you. I've followed your work for a long time, actually, as well as that of Ian Stevenson. We're going to talk about all of this, but really, I think the best place perhaps to begin is really talking about your clinical and professional background. Before you became involved in this research, what was your main research interest and what brought you to where you are today?
Well, I am a child psychiatrist, and I still work as a child psychiatrist seeing children. I did my residency, my training in psychiatry and child psychiatry at the University of Virginia. And when I was in training, I heard about Ian Stevenson, who had been the former chair of the Department of Psychiatry, who had stepped down as chair to focus full time on studying things like children who said they remembered a past life. I thought it was interesting that somebody would do that, but I never actually met Ian during my training. And after I finished, I went into private practice, just doing standard child psychiatry. And then I wasn't doing research. I was purely doing clinical work. Then in my early 30s, when my wife and I got married, she was open to things like reincarnation and psychic abilities and that sort of thing. She's a clinical psychologist. And it got me intrigued by the topic. And I started reading up on it and became fascinated by this idea of taking a very serious-minded approach to a question like, can we survive after death? Then we saw in the local paper that Ian Stevenson's research division had gotten a grant to do a new study on near-death experiences. So I decided to call just to see if they needed some help interviewing patients for that study, just kind of as a hobby along with my private practice. That sort of got my foot in the door, and I never actually interviewed patients for that study, but I started to come to the research meetings. At that point, Ian Stevenson was approaching 80 and did not have anyone at UVA to carry on his work with these children, so I started getting more involved, eventually left my private practice and joined full-time at UVA in the year 2000. So I've now been at this for 20 years.
Yeah, that's quite a while to be following this work. You know, prior to officially becoming associated with UVA, had there been any formative experiences during those early years that really encouraged you to say, hey, I see my life, my interests, my career going more in this direction? Had anything really influenced you in those early years?
No, I mean, being in private practice, it was rewarding. I mean, you see most patients get better and they get better fairly quickly, but it wasn't particularly fulfilling. It was just sort of one case after another, the phone messages pile up and then you go the next day and you start it all over again. So when I sort of became intrigued by kind of the big picture of even the potential for life after death, it sort of filled a role that my work was not filling. But there's not like there was no, I didn't have a memory of a past life or have a near death experience or anything like that led me down this path.
I see. You know, of course, many, especially clinical professionals, but really more broadly, many in academia would look at this subject and they would say, there's really no way we can know. There's really no way we can, you know, verify these sorts of claims. In your opinion, and I'm interested in knowing how you felt about the topic before you became involved with it, had you had a similar sort of attitude of, you know, maybe dismissal or maybe general skepticism before you began the work? Or had you always been fairly open-minded to the possibility that, hey, you know, maybe in the world of the sciences, we haven't solved all of life's great mysteries?
Well, I guess I would say somewhere between being open and being skeptical. I mean, I didn't know enough about this work to have an opinion one way or another. And really, that's the case for most people in medicine and science, that they probably don't even know about our work. But, you know, you mentioned verification. I mean, that's the whole key here. And that's what we're trying to see. Is there evidence that these claims about past life memories, can the memories be verified to actually have come from a past life? And if so, then of course, what do we make of that? But I think there are some things I will dismiss out of hand, but I certainly try not to be too dismissive. And you know, you approach any area with enough of sort of open-minded skepticism to try to determine for yourself, is there anything there? And as I looked at this more and more, it certainly looks like there is something there.
Certainly. Again, we're talking with Dr. Jim Tucker. He is associated with the University of Virginia in what is today known as the Division of Perceptual Studies. The majority of his work looks at the possibility that children seem to have memories that cannot be accounted for in their own short time on Earth, their living experience. And it's strongly suggestive, in Dr. Tucker's view, that this may be evidence of having lived past lives. Dr. Tucker, I'd like to get into this with you about maybe some of the key criteria for what we could use to identify a good case. I know that you go through a number of these in your books, prediction of rebirth, an announcing dream, some of these things. Can we go down the list and then talk about each of them?
Sure. The predictions, yes, there are cases where a person before they die predicts or says that they would like to come back to a particular family or to a particular place. Sometimes those add to the evidence. Sometimes, to be honest, they subtract. I mean, if a person makes a prediction, I'm going to be born to such and such couple, and then that couple thinks that the child is that person reborn, it makes you wonder how they may have overinterpreted any statements the child made.
Sure.
As far as announcing dreams, it's sort of the same thing. So, in a number of cases, the someone in the family, usually the child's mother, during the pregnancy will dream that somebody will come and either announce that they are going to be reborn to her or ask to be reborn to her. And again, these are usually in cultures with a belief in reincarnation. This can create the expectation that this child is a particular person reborn, which, you know, then makes you wonder how people around the child interpret any statements the child makes. And then there are cases that where the child is born with birthmarks or even full birth defects that match wounds, usually the fatal wounds on the body of the identified previous person. So not only does the child have memories of that past life, but they also have physical, tangible evidence of a connection to that past life. And Ian Stevenson studied hundreds of these cases, and as much as possible tried to document that the child's birthmarks did in fact match the wounds on the previous person. Then you come to the statements that the child makes about a past life, and these are really the core of this phenomenon, that the child says that he or she lived before and will give details of in varying specificity. If they are specific enough, then people have often identified a previous person whose life seems to match the child's statements. And in that case, we try to verify, first of all, exactly what the child has said, and secondly, how well does it match to the purported past life. Now, along with that will often be behaviors or emotions that the child shows that seem connected to this past life. So, in many cases, in the majority of cases, actually, the previous person died by some sort of unnatural means, murder, suicide, combat, accident, that sort of thing. And in those cases, 35% of the children will show phobias toward the mode of death. So they will show this intense fear toward however the previous person died. So particularly prominent in drowning cases. If the previous person drowned, then in many of those, the children will show an intense fear of being in water, even from infancy on. They will also sometimes in their play will reenact things from the past life, most often the previous occupation, occasionally the previous death. They will also show very intense emotional connection to this material. They may cry and beg their parents on a daily basis to take them to their previous family or their previous home. So these are kind of the features that all together make up this phenomenon of children who purport to remember a past life.
Yes. You know, Dr. Tucker, I must admit, I have something of a intimate connection to some of the criteria you're describing. My own mother, when she was very, very young, reportedly woke up one night very, very upset. My grandmother runs into the room and finds her in the crib crying, saying that her husband was going to kill her and the children. Not the kind of thing you expect a 2 or 3 year old to say generally. Would you argue that the data that you have collected about such recollections from people, especially at a young age, does this seem to indicate that trauma is a key factor in the carrying over of the memories into the child's consciousness?
Well, it certainly seems to be. So with our cases, 70% of the kids remember a life that ended by some sort of unnatural means. And that's, you know, far beyond what you would expect in the general population. So there does seem to be something about trauma that's connected. And of course, if you think about memories in this life and PTSD, unfortunately, it's often the traumatic ones that stick with us that we can't get rid of even if we would like to. So there does seem to be sort of a power of traumatic memories that in these cases, by appearance, that this power has even carried on into another life. You know, the example that you give about your mom, yes, that's pretty unusual behavior. Now, people may say, well, she just had a bad dream. Well, maybe she did just have a bad dream. However, what if after she woke up, she said, I lived in, you know, wherever, Topeka, Kansas, and my name was whatever, Jane Doe, and you go and look up and you see that somebody named Jane Doe lived in Topeka and she and her children were killed by her husband. So, you know, that's what we're trying to do. Can the child's memories be verified? If not, then with the example of your mom, there's not a whole lot we can say. We can say it's interesting or intriguing that there may be something there, but that there's not enough data to really tell us one way or the other what has happened. But that is certainly in our strongest cases, we can't just say that there's no way to tell if something remarkable has happened.
Certainly. And of course, naturally, this would step over into the realm of speculation. But when we see the way that we have conditions like PTSD, which result from severe trauma, psychological influence of trauma, and the way that people create coping mechanisms that they often carry throughout their lives in dealing with that trauma. I find it very interesting, Dr. Tucker, that this is one of the strongest criteria. I think you said around 70% of the cases that you've looked at where trauma or unnatural death and recollections of these incidents seems to be carried over, because that certainly seems to be something that people cope with in life when they have dealt with trauma. That seems to point to a unique aspect of the mind and consciousness, and of course, it also seems to bespeak the idea of a element of consciousness that maybe operates outside of the physical brain if these things could be carried over. Is that anything you can even speculate on?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, that's what the evidence would suggest, and it may well be that in these cases, because the traumatic memories carry on, that they carry with them other memories of that life, so that the child will remember more than just how they died. But it may be that those death memories that really are the core that lead the other memories to carry over. Now, you know, as far as how that happens, we're not to the point of being able to describe a mechanism, just like there's so much to learn about the mind in this life and how traumatic memories can be created and how they can be dealt with and then put down. But the phenomenon nonetheless exists, that there are these apparent memories that the children have.
Certainly. We are talking with Dr. Jim Tucker of the University of Virginia, and he is a researcher who has spent decades looking at children's memories of what appear to be past lives. Of course, many in academia may rule out this possibility, but again, there is a tremendous amount of data that seems to support it. We're going to talk about some of the cases he has investigated with Dr. Tucker when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. What a conversation we are having with Dr. Jim Tucker. He is with the University of Virginia Division of Perceptual Studies, and their scientific work for decades now has involved studies of children who have very unusual memories early in life, to say the least. In fact, these appear to point to the possibility of past lives, or what is more broadly known as reincarnation. We're going to get back into that conversation with him here in a moment. I do want to remind you, of course, if you like this podcast and you enjoy the conversations we have, the conversation doesn't stop here. We every week put out the additional edition for X subscribers. That is an entirely separate podcast, an addenda to the conversation that we have, which features additional news, additional commentary, and insights about all the things we discuss here on this program. We also, of course, have the monthly Enigmas special, where we hone in on a specific case and we go deep. You don't want to forget to check out those while you are a subscriber. And if you aren't already a subscriber, here's how you do it. It's right there in your show notes. There's a link to where you can subscribe. You can also go to MicahHanks.com/podcast and subscribe there. Just look for X memberships up in the upper right-hand corner of the page. It's only $7 a month or $77 a year, and we definitely appreciate the support of the programs that we offer and, of course, the very science-minded guests who are looking at the areas of science which maybe aren't as often discussed by academicians. That is certainly the case this week with our guest, Dr. Jim Tucker of the University of Virginia, a guy whose work I have followed for a long time and somebody who I really respect for being a scientist who tries to apply scientific methodology toward what many would rule out of hand as an unlikely claim. What exactly are children remembering when they have these recollections of what appear to be past lives? I mean, it seems pretty obvious, but again, how can science be applied toward this so that we can recognize this as a legitimate phenomenon? And more importantly, what does this say about science? What does this say about consciousness? What does this say about quantum physics? We're going to get into all of that with Dr. Tucker here in just a moment. But primarily what I want to look at with you, Dr. Tucker, is some of the cases that you have personally investigated and which have helped to build the body of information we have at our disposal in terms of children's past life memories. And really, maybe this goes all the way back to the 1960s. I know Dr. Ian Stevenson began this work. He also conducted inquiries that appear to show that this phenomena extends beyond just, for instance, the Western world and the United States. Can we talk about his work and also perhaps the worldliness of this phenomenon?
Yeah, well, it's certainly a worldwide phenomenon. I mean, cases have been found wherever anybody has looked, and they've been found on all the continents except Antarctica. And when Ian started this work, he actually started in Asia because that's where he could find the cases. So, you know, and he started in India and Thailand, Burma, places like that. And in those places, with the general belief in reincarnation, if a child starts talking about a past life, then often the families will talk about it, word will spread, and then eventually one of the Ian's associates will learn about the case. Sometimes it'd be in the newspaper. And then after a while, Ian would go for a month or two and investigate cases. One of the criticisms of his work early on was that all the cases he was finding were in places with a belief in reincarnation. So the idea was that this was just a cultural phenomenon. But we now can say with certainty it's not just a cultural phenomenon, because we are hearing from more and more American parents about their children also describing memories of a past life. And this is in families that did not have any belief in reincarnation before their child started talking about a past life, and of course in a culture without a general belief in reincarnation. So it does not seem to be culture bound, but instead is a phenomenon of early childhood that happens in a certain, we think, fairly small percentage of children, but that happens all over.
Certainly. I want to get into some cases you've looked at also, but before we do, I'm very interested in the fact that Dr. Stevenson's work had focused primarily on incidents in the Eastern world where there was a preponderance of not only these sorts of cases that he could find, but that seemingly on account of cultural beliefs, spiritual beliefs related to the reality of reincarnation. That interests me because I think that the modern strictly materialistic mind, and we could talk about the philosophy of all of this and materialism a bit later on, but the materialistic mindset would simply hold, I think, that, well, these are spiritual beliefs, and hence why people believe these things, but there's no veracity to them. There's nothing in science that corroborates this. One other way we might look at that would be that perhaps the collective experience over time, and I mean this going back thousands of years perhaps, you know, even prior to written systems of collecting history, maybe even oral traditions carrying over into more modern times and, of course, written records, they seem to bespeak a knowledge of this phenomenon. So one other way this might be interpreted is that this is something that humans have had knowledge of for quite some time. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, certainly if you look at the sort of the ancient religions there's the belief in reincarnation. And I have wondered at times if, I mean, we don't really know how common the cases are anywhere, that they're easiest to find in places in Asia. It doesn't necessarily mean they're more common. But if they are, it may well be that there's a genetic component to the ability to remember past lives, which would lead them to be more common in some places than others. And it might be that the presence of these cases hundreds of years ago, or even thousands of years ago, led to the religious beliefs that we see, part of the religious beliefs that we see in those places. So it's not that being Buddhist or Hindu or whatever, that culture creates the cases, but more the reverse, that the cases created this, made this as part of their belief system as the culture developed.
Yeah, I find that to be very interesting. And often we see that traditional beliefs, oral traditions that are carried out throughout time, they're perhaps initially dismissed, but from time to time we find archaeological or even historical verification, and we are able to confirm that many of these traditions actually have a basis in fact. So it wouldn't surprise me that there's a similar case to be made here. Getting over into some of the actual cases that you've looked at, I know that there are a number that you have detailed in your work that certainly are among the what we might call cornerstones of your research. Let's look at a few of these. James Leninger, I believe, had been one, a gentleman who had a memory of something that is a fairly common experience in your research, that involving a past recollection of experience in battle. In his case, I believe it was World War II. Can we talk about that case?
Sure. So, yeah, James Leninger is this little boy. Well, he's not little anymore, but he was this little boy in Louisiana, who's the child of this Christian couple there. And his father in particular was quite opposed to the idea of past lives before James started, talking about one, even after James started talking about one. So around the time of James's second birthday, he started having terrible nightmares multiple times a week in which he would be kicking his legs up in the air and screaming, "Airplane crash on fire, little man can't get out." And these nightmares went on. I talked after I met with James and his parents. I also talked with his aunt, who said, you can believe how disturbing these things were to witness. It really looked like someone fighting for his life. And then during the day, he would take his little toy airplanes and crash them into the coffee table and say, airplane crash on fire. And he would do this over and over again. Got a picture of the coffee table. There are dozens of scratches and dents in it. So he really looked like a child who had been traumatized, that was somehow dealing with memories of a plane crash. And then his parents were able to have several conversations with him after his second birthday, and he said how his plane had crashed on fire. It had been shot down by the Japanese, and he said how he had flown a Corsair. Now, I'd never heard of a Corsair, but it was a special plane that was developed during World War II. And he also said that he had flown off of a boat, and his parents asked him the name of the boat, and he said Natoma. Which I think we can all agree, if you're going to try to guess the name of a U.S. aircraft carrier, Natoma seems like a pretty unlikely choice. After that conversation, his dad went online and did an internet search, and this was back in the early 2000s, had to do quite a search, but eventually found information on a USS Natoma Bay. And what he did was he printed out this information, and the footer of where he printed it out shows the date that he printed out, which was August of 2000. James was born in April of 1998. So this documents that by the time James was 28 months old, that Natoma was part of the story. And his dad learned that the USS Natoma Bay was this escort carrier that in fact was stationed in the Pacific during World War II. So his parents would ask him who he was then, and he always just said me or James, which they didn't make anything of at the time. And then one time they asked him who else was there, and he said Jack Larson. This was all when he was two, and then when he was 2.5, his father had gotten a book on Iwo Jima to give to his own father, James's grandfather. And they were looking through it one day. He was looking through it one day when James came and got in his lap. And James pointed at a picture of Iwo Jima and said, that's where my plane was shot down. And his dad said, what? And he said, my airplane got shot down there, Daddy. Which just floored his dad that his 2.5-year-old was talking that way. And then he learned that the Natoma Bay did, in fact, take part in the Iwo Jima operation. Eventually, when James was 4.5, his dad went to a Natoma Bay reunion, and he learned that there was one and only one pilot from the ship that was killed in the Iwo Jima operation. It was this young man from Pennsylvania named James Houston, and he discovered that Houston had in fact flown a Corsair. He was actually flying a different plane when he was killed, but he had definitely flown a Corsair. He was part of the squadron that tested it for the Navy. And he learned that Houston's plane crashed exactly as James had described. James talked about getting hit in the engine, the plane bursting into flames, crashing into water, and quickly sinking. And that's exactly what happened to Houston's plane. And the pilot of the plane next to Houston's on the day he was killed was named Jack Larson.
Wow.
So, you know, you add all this up and you've got very specific details, including names, that could only match one person. And it's this young man from Pennsylvania named James Houston, who appeared to have died, you know, 50 years plus from the time that before James was born.
Dr. Tucker, I just have to say that is a pretty remarkable story, if indeed all of the facts can be validated. Now, you, of course, have had communication with the family, and you have interviewed many family members who bore witness to these elements. Are you still in touch with the family, or James, for that matter?
Occasionally, mostly actually with his dad. Not super often, but you know, once or twice a year often. James is now a young adult, and in fact, he's in the military, and seems to be doing fine these days. You know, he's gone on with his life. As far as the verification part, the good thing is that even though his dad did most of the research, and of course we prefer to do it ourselves, but even though his dad did most of the research, we've got good documentation of these items that James said, good documentation that was made before anyone around him knew anything about this pilot, James Houston. And the documentation shows that James did give these very specific details that could only have matched James Houston.
Is it merely a coincidence that they named their son James? I asked that primarily because, well, it is interesting that he has now entered the military himself. That raises a number of interesting questions or speculations, at least. But you also mention among the criteria this idea of an announcing dream, sometimes that experienced by another family member than the one who experiences the memories. Had there been a mother or anyone in this case who had any kind of dreams or anything that they recalled in advance of what young James would recall?
No. And yeah, I think the James thing is probably just a coincidence. I mean, most of our cases, the child does not have the same name as the previous person. But it's interesting that when James got old enough to draw pictures, he would always sign them James 3. And I thought it might be because he was 3 years old at the time. But his parents said, no, they asked him about it. And he said, I'm the third James. I'm James 3. Well, it turned out that this James Houston was James Houston Jr., which would make James Leininger the third James. But as far as any sort of connection, any particular reason why he was named James, it did not seem to be linked to the past life.
Right. What about James as a young adult? Does he still have any recollection either of these experiences or of, as a child, saying these things to his parents?
Yes, he does. And unfortunately, the only specific memory he has still from the past life is the sense of dread as his plane was about to crash, the sense of dread that he was about to be killed. And I talked with him a while back, and I was asking essentially about any memories of a near-death experience of kind of floating above the body, some sense of peacefulness. But he said no, that the only thing he recalled was just this terrible dread of being about to die.
Now, Dr. Tucker, is that something that other experiencers of these apparent past life memories have recalled? Do they actually have any kind of recollection of a sort of near-death experience that accompanied their actual passing from the mortal realm the first time around?
Yeah, about 20% of kids will talk about memories of events between lives. And they can vary. Some of them essentially describe what sounds like a near-death experience, a floating above the body, then often coming into contact with spiritual beings of some sort. Others will just say that they floated above the body and then just stayed there, either above the body or they stayed around the previous family. Some of the kids will talk about going to other realms like heaven. The American kids may use the word heaven. And then some will also talk about either choosing their next parents or being guided to them. Some will talk about observing their parents before they were born, sometimes giving verifiable details about what their parents were doing. So in James's case, one day he said to his father that he was glad that he had chosen his parents to be his parents, and his father asked him what he meant, and he said that he saw them when they were when they were at a big pink hotel eating on the beach. In fact, he said that this was in Hawaii. Well, it turned out that his parents had gone to Hawaii before he was born and stayed at a big pink hotel. And the last night of the trip, they had, in fact, eaten on the beach. And that was the time when they began to try to get pregnant. They didn't actually conceive for a couple more months, but that was when the intention started. And that's coincided with when James said he chose them to be his parents.
That is so very interesting. It certainly raises a lot of questions. Of course, our guest, Dr. Jim Tucker, has spent decades now examining cases like these, as outlined in his book, Before, Children's Memories of Previous Lives. And of course, I've got a lot more questions for Dr. Tucker about his research into this fascinating phenomenon. We will get into more of that with Dr. Tucker when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Children have memories of past lives. Based on the work of our guest, Dr. Jim Tucker, it certainly seems to be the case that some of them do. Dr. Tucker is a child psychiatrist at the University of Virginia at their Division of Perceptual Studies, and he has spent decades looking into this intriguing phenomenon, which does indeed appear to corroborate ideas about reincarnation that have been discussed in different world traditions, philosophies, religions, throughout time, which of course is a very interesting observation in itself regarding all of this. But Dr. Tucker, of course, applies science to the study of these past life memories. And I want to get back into this conversation with him here. Dr. Tucker, you're describing some of the children who have these sort of in-between memories sometimes of their parents prior to being born. We also have interesting instances like a young girl named Abby who remembered, apparently actually being a member of the family beforehand, what she told her mother while she was receiving a bath as a young girl is, you know, Mom, I used to give you baths. And this seems to lead to a recollection of having been, as she claimed, the great-grandmother in that very same family. How often do we see this occurring where someone who claims to have been a family member in the same family lineage actually is born as a child to one of their descendants?
Yeah, it's a minority of cases, but a substantial minority. It's what we call same family cases. And we do have a number of those, either recalling being, for instance, a grandparent or sometimes being a sibling. So it's not necessarily a descendant, but it's somebody that's connected to the child. And, you know, with those cases, I mean, there's the inherent weakness from our point of view that the child could have accessed information about the past person from just overhearing things. Now, we've had ones where the parents felt certain the child had never heard some of the details they gave, but it's hard for us to be certain that, in fact, they hadn't. But, you know, those stories can be meaningful on an emotional level because it will often include some potential for healing. So the person will say, I came back to show my love more because I didn't do it in the last life, or things like that. And certainly for the families, it can be quite meaningful to feel like their loved one has returned.
Certainly. I know that you touched on the idea that in certain parts of the world, there may be a genetic component to people being able to experience these memories. Something else I would like to ask you about is, and as you address in your book, the possibility in terms of different explanations for the phenomena that we're witnessing, and we'll get more into depth into a lot of those later. But one that you outline, which I think is relevant here, is the possibility of genetic memory. In cases where we have a same family incidents like this, is that a possible interpretation? I mean, I really wonder if there's any way we could prove that, but I mean, is that one line of thought that might help us to explain these sorts of experiences?
Probably not. I mean, genetic memory is kind of an iffy proposition anyway, but right. Most of the cases, the child is not a direct descendant of the previous person, which they would have to be for the memory to carry over through the genes. And beyond that, 70% of the kids have memories of how they died in the past life, which of course would have been well after the genes had been passed on. So if the genes are somehow connected to the memories, it is not in any sort of obvious way.
I see. This may seem like a rather strange question, but I do think it's very relevant to the discussion. Has there ever been an instance, to your knowledge, where a child has memories of a past life where they don't recall necessarily being human?
Yeah, we occasionally get those reports, and of course, they're completely unverifiable.
Sure.
But they are there. There are not many of them. Even in places where there's a belief that souls can transmigrate across species, we get very few of those. And, you know, it's worth keeping in mind that our cases with intact memories, even if you accept them, they aren't necessarily the universal pattern. And in our cases, it seems that for memories to carry over, then most likely it's a fairly similar kind of life. So it's usually someone from the same country, and sometimes, as we're just saying, sometimes even from the same family. So these more distant past lives, like being an animal or occasionally being on another planet or whatever, seem much less likely to produce memories that would carry over.
Yeah, those do seem a little less likely. And even if we were to take into consideration the possibility of such memories, it would be very difficult, for instance, to verify claims of a person having experienced life on another planet, like you mentioned. I mean, have you actually received those cases? And if you don't wish to elaborate on those particularly, that's fine. But I'm just interested, have you actually received cases like that?
Yes, but very rarely.
I see.
Again, they would be completely unverifiable and may well just be fantasy. I mean, when you're talking about something like that, then it becomes increasingly hard to separate, you know, what's a fantasy story versus an actual memory.
Yeah, although that begs a good question. You know, are there certain criteria that you have for what make a story more likely to be fantasy? Even if someone's, you know, recalling what they believe to be a past life, I'm sure you've probably noticed certain criteria that make the past life recollections less likely to be deemed authentic. What sorts of criteria might there be for that?
Well, I mean, the biggest one is, can the memories be verified?
Mm-hmm.
So then it's not a fantasy. But beyond that, a lot of the parents say that they can tell the difference, that the children, how they tell these events is very different, that there's sort of a sing-songy, playful quality that they're fantasizing versus this very serious presentation when they're talking about this stuff. And also, I mean, fantasies often, sort of by definition, have fantastic elements in them. So you've got magic or you've got dragons or whatever. And those things are not what we're seeing with these memories, of course, that they are completely down-to-earth, ordinary kinds of things. These kids are not talking about being kings or queens or almost never talk about being famous people, but rather describing a quite ordinary kind of existence, except for the death, which is often not so ordinary. But otherwise, just an ordinary person like anyone else.
There's a really particularly interesting case I want to ask you about that your research involves here in a moment. Before we get into that case, which involves Ryan Hammonds, I also want to ask you about the rather controversial method of hypnosis. Now, my understanding, of course, is that your research relies on children who, in their waking experience, although sometimes in dreams too, but nonetheless, there's still no effort, you know, being made by a psychologist to enhance the child's ability to recall things. Has there ever been an instance where something like hypnotic regression in a clinical setting has been used? And what are your feelings about the efficacy of that in the furtherance of obtaining information? Is that beneficial or does that actually potentially muddy the water?
Yeah, well, it's certainly used by people. I mean, there is past life hypnotic regression, but we are rather skeptical of it. But there are psychiatrists and psychologists and then essentially lay people who will hypnotize folks. And it may well be therapeutic. I mean, the person, for instance, may have a phobia that then gets relieved with these sessions. But there's not much reason to think that they're actually accessing a true past life. And in fact, there's good reason to think that they're usually not. Partly because hypnosis is an extremely unreliable tool for recovering memories, even in this life. I mean, it can produce amazing hits like license plate numbers at crime scenes or whatever, but many times the mind just fills in the blanks. And then it's very hard for the person to tell if it was an actual memory or just something that they created. A lot of the cases, I mean, to be fair, many of them are completely unverifiable because they're ancient lies, and there's no way to say one way or the other. But there are plenty of them that include sort of historical absurdities that couldn't possibly be true. There have even been cases where the person was rehypnotized, asked where they got that information from. It turned out from a book that they had read years before, completely forgotten about, but somehow the unconscious mind, which can, of course, do amazing things, and then put the information together and created this past life. So, as you say, what we go for are these cases where children start talking about a past life, which seems to be a very different phenomenon from adults undergoing hypnotic regression.
Indeed. And thank you for answering those questions. You know, straying a bit from the narrative, but those kind of provide us a better degree of clarity, I think, about the research process and the criteria used for, again, weighing some of these claims. You know, Dr. Tucker, before we talk about Ryan Hammons a bit, I do recall in his book, The Demon-Haunted World, the late Carl Sagan even saying, however dubious they may seem, there do appear to be some cases involving child's memories of possible past lives that warrant investigation. Do you recall seeing Sagan's statements about that?
Sure. And of course, Carl Sagan was certainly a skeptic. But yes, he identified three areas in parapsychology that he thought warranted serious study because there was some evidence to support them. And one of them was this phenomenon of young children recalling memories of a past life.
Yes, indeed. Ryan Hammons is a case that comes to mind. He remembered, well, I'll let you tell us the story, in fact, but he certainly had a rather specific memory of his profession from a past life. Can you tell us about his story, how you first learned of it, and what your investigation of it entailed?
Sure. So we got a letter one day from a mom in Oklahoma who said that she and her husband are just ordinary folks. She worked in the county clerk's office. Her husband's a police officer. But their little boy, Ryan, their five-year-old, for the last year had talked about wanting to go home to Hollywood, and he would cry and beg his mother to take him home. And to try to help him deal with this, she got some books on Hollywood from their public library, and they were looking through one day when there was a picture from an old movie called Night After Night, and there's a picture of several men. And Ryan pointed at one and said, hey, Mama, that's George. We did a picture together. And then he pointed to another one and said, and Mama, that guy's me. I found me. Well, the first one he pointed to was George Raft, who was quite a well-known actor in his day, but is not so much known anymore. But the one that he said he had been was an extra with no lines in the movie. So Ryan's mom wrote to me to see if I could help determine who this fellow was. So I went to Oklahoma and I visited the family. And then afterwards, as we were trying to figure this out, Ryan's mom was sending me emails, sometimes on a daily basis, with all of these statements that Ryan was making about past life. Eventually, with the help of a Hollywood archivist, we were able to figure out who this guy was. The archivist, she went to the library of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, got all the materials on the movie, most of which were about stars, but she found one picture of this guy that Ryan had pointed to, and it was a guy named Marty Martin. And to be honest, with the life that Ryan was describing, I thought it was unlikely that an extra with no lines in a movie had had the kind of life that Ryan described. In fact, Marty Martin did. So Ryan said how he had danced on stage in New York, and Marty Martin danced on Broadway. Ryan said that he then went to Hollywood and worked in movies, as Marty Martin did. He said that he then worked for an agency where people changed their names. Marty Martin started a successful talent agency. Ryan said how he had seen the world from big ships and talked about visiting Paris, and Marty Martin and his wife went to Europe on the Queen Mary. Ryan said how he had a big house with a swimming pool, which Marty Martin did. And Ryan said that the street address had the word rock or mount in it, and Marty Martin lived on North Roxbury. Ryan also said one time that he didn't know why God would let you get to 61 and then make you come back again as a baby, which is kind of an interesting thing to even think about. But Marty Martin, he died in 1964, and his death certificate said that he's only 59. So it looked like Ryan was wrong about that. But then I looked into it, and family members said he was 64. I found marriage listings, census records, everything that gave birth dates that indicated, in fact, Marty Martin was 61 when he died. So even though the death certificate said Marty Martin is 59, in fact, Ryan was correct when he said 61. Altogether, we documented over 50 of Ryan's statements did, in fact, match Marty Martin's life.
That certainly builds a strong case for this kind of phenomena. Would you regard this as being possibly the best case that you've looked at?
Well, I think the two that we've just talked about, Ryan and James Leininger, I would say those are the two strongest cases that I've personally investigated. Now, of course, there are hundreds of others that other people have, including, of course, Ian Stevenson. But for me, yeah, those two are certainly strong ones.
I would certainly have to agree on that point. Again, our guest is Dr. Jim Tucker of the University of Virginia, and his work there at the university's Division of Perceptual Studies looks at cases where children seem to recall memories of past lives. We'll talk more with Dr. Tucker about the best cases he's looked at and how science can be applied to this when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. Continuing our conversation here with Dr. Jim Tucker of the University of Virginia. And of course, we have been having quite a conversation about his work as outlined in his book Before, Children's Memories of Previous Lives. We'll definitely have that linked in the show notes for those who might want to read this and talk about a very interesting read. I mean, this really has the potential, a subject like this, for reshaping a lot of our understanding of space-time, nature, physics, and really what it means to be alive in general. Now, before the break, of course, we were talking about this incident involving Ryan Hammonds, a very interesting case. Dr. Tucker, I also want to ask you, as far as cases you've looked at, are there any others that come to mind, though, that stand out to you that are comparable to the two we've looked at?
Well, recently, I interviewed a family where the little boy had talked about a life in the Vietnam War. And with that one, he gave a last name in the state where he said he was from, and it was an unusual last name. His mom then went on, found the Vietnam Memorial website, and was shocked to see that someone from the state was, in fact, killed in Vietnam. And the little boy had said how he was 21 when he died, which, in fact, was what had happened with this guy. But since we had the name, I then did some online sleuthing and found pictures from his past life. So when I went to visit the family, I brought with me pairs of pictures, where one of the pictures was from the past life and the other one was just a control picture. So they included places like the school or house, but then also pictures from the boy's high school yearbook, as well as family pictures. So anyway, all together, I showed him eight pairs of pictures. A couple of them he didn't make guesses on, but for the ones where he did make a choice, he was 6 out of 6. So, you know, that would certainly, you know, it's like flipping a coin, having it come up hit 6 times. The odds of that just occurring by chance are quite small. So it was a different kind of evidence, but these sort of recognition tests also can contribute significant evidence that the child has, in fact, remembered the past life.
Yes, certainly. I know that also that In your research, you also have criteria when you're studying these cases that you use to, or rather as possible alternative explanations that might account for some of these. These range from everything from, again, a more skeptical interpretation like fraud or fantasy, which we've kind of touched on already, to knowledge that may be acquired through normal means and other things. Can we go down the list of alternative explanations that in your work you've outlined, you talk about these in your book, and the pros and cons of some of these?
Sure. Well, certainly, I mean, there's no one ordinary explanation that can explain away this phenomenon. I'll say that. But one of the most worthy ones for many of the cases is in a lot of the cases in Asia, no one wrote down the child statements before they went looking for the previous person. So the argument is that after the families met, then they ended up misremembering basically how much information the child in fact had shown, that they remember that the child had more specific details than he or she actually had. Now, the problem with that explanation is that we've now got a lot of cases where we do have written records, like the two I just told you about, and they in fact verify that the child had this information. And in fact, when people have looked at it, the ones with the written records vastly indicate more memories in those cases than in the ones that where the people are trying to remember, the parents are trying to remember retrospectively. So there's no reason to think that the parents create this false information that they credit the child with. Beyond that, like you say, fantasy. Well, if this is all just fantasy, then it involves one heck of a coincidence in some of these cases that it would just happened to match somebody who lived and died. So, you know, I think most of us, as you look at James Leininger's case with naming Jack Larson and the Natoma and the details of the crash and all that, I think we can say that coincidence is not a very plausible explanation. Now, it may well be for in cases where the information is less specific, but not in the stronger cases. Fraud is an interesting issue. And in fact, at one point, Ian Stevenson published a paper of seven cases of either sort of fraud or at least sort of self-fraud, self-delusion, where the people became convinced that the child was remembering past life, even though there's no good reason to think that they were. And we have occasionally seen cases in Asia where there was strong suspicion that the parents were claiming the past life of some wealthy person nearby to try to get money from the family. That's a tiny percentage of cases, but it is ones that in some cases is worth considering. Now, you know, in the cases like Ryan or James, the families would have absolutely no reason to create this elaborate years-long fraud. So again, I would not consider it plausible in our strongest cases. There's also the question, a very reasonable question, could the child have learned about these things through ordinary ways, through overhearing or reading or whatever? And when you've got a case from the same village or the same family, again, that warrants very serious consideration. But then you've got these cases where hundreds of miles and many years separate the two families, and there just seems no way possible that this very young child could have somehow gathered all this information and put it into a coherent story about past life. So at that point, you're to the point of considering sort of extraordinary explanations or paranormal, we might say. They would include, some people wonder about, well, it's not really a past life, but it's more sort of a possession where there's this spirit or soul or whatever that kind of is over the child, making them think they remember the past life. That's hard to rule out. It's certainly not as straightforward as it being an actual past life memory. You know, there's certainly, it would have great difficulty explaining the birthmarks. And also just the strong emotional component of these children. I mean, they are not just giving a list of facts, but they are describing what to them are these very important memories that they've had. There's also the question of, could it be through psychic abilities? Now, if you're open to psychic abilities, that possibility, most of our children do not show any other psychic abilities. And again, it's hard to see how being psychic would create birthmarks. And also, again, it wouldn't be a great explanation for the emotional component. That certainly from these children, they are not just have this information in their mind or can guess through psychic abilities, but more this is things that they've experienced. All that being said, that kind of gets us to past lives or reincarnation. But the way that I like to phrase it is that we now have good evidence that some children have memories of a past life. But exactly what that means, I actually don't prefer the term reincarnation because that includes various sort of religious connotations that may or may not apply to these cases. But in any case, we seem to be left with children indeed having memories that came from a life in the past.
Indeed. Dr. Tucker, I have to say it's been great talking with you. And for those who are interested in your work and would like to find out more about it online, where can they go to look for that?
Well, they can go to jimbytucker.com or they can go to UVA DOPS, D-O-P-S, which is Division for Social Studies, uvadops.org, or they can just Google my name and find us that way.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Tucker, I want to thank you very much for your time. It's been a very fascinating conversation. Hopefully we can do it again sometime, and best of luck with your ongoing research.
Well, thanks very much, and thanks for having me.
Indeed, it has sincerely been my pleasure. And of course, as always, we will have information about Dr. Tucker and his work available in the show notes so that those of you at home can keep up with his work. It's very important work indeed. And that, of course, is going to be the final word on this week's edition of the program. This show, as always, is produced here in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control are Race Hobbs and Warren Breger. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks, and other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. As always, I am yours truly, Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening, and as always, stay strange out there.